Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you're listening today. Our producers, by the way, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Jason Croft is at the controls. If you want to get really worried about global warming, you can easily find plenty of alarming evidence for it. Melting glaciers and permafrost, dying coral, large droughts, intensified storm cycles, they're not exactly proof. The thing is, proof that would convince everyone would come in the form of a global disaster. So how do we know what we think we know might know about climate change, especially that change which we are inducing? And how do we know what we might do about it? And what about the politics of both the science and the rolling up the sleeves part of addressing our addiction to fossil fuels? Well, a few small questions, as usual, to take up here on Focus 580, and we'll try to do that the best we can during this hour. Our guest is William Sweet. He is senior news editor at IEEE Spectrum, which is the flagship publication of the IEEE, the world's largest professional technology association. It is a monthly magazine for technology innovators, business leaders, and the intellectually curious. Spectrum also explores future technology trends and the impact of those trends on society and business. And William Sweet also has written for the Los Angeles Times, the New Republic, the New York Times, and the Progressive. He's also the author of the book Kicking the Carbon Habit, Global Warming and the Case for Renewable and Nuclear Energy, recently published by Columbia University Press. The title of the book is a pretty good description of its content and focus, and that's what we'll talk about during this hour. As we talk with William Sweet, we invite you into the conversation. If you would like to join us, your questions are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. We also have a toll-free line anywhere here in the Midwest if you're listening on the air, or if you're listening online anywhere in the continental U.S., use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And William Sweet joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Please call me Bill.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. In the preface of your book, you identify its purpose as essentially twofold, the first of which is to get across that there's been a revolution in climate science in the last 50 years. We'll get to the second part of your purpose, but I wonder if you would talk about this revolution to start.
Well, I'll try to be reasonably brief, just to give your listeners here, our listeners here, a sense of some of the things that I talk about in the book. I find talking to people generally who are often quite well informed about these kinds of issues and quite interested in them, that they only have kind of a vague idea of why scientists think human activities are warming the world and why it's something to be seriously concerned about. That is to say, they don't really have too much sense of what the scientific basis for this is, how people have actually arrived at these conclusions. People often tend to sort of believe it or not believe it, depending on their attitudes and all kinds of things. But I find that even well-informed people often don't have too good a sense of what the basis actually is. So in a few chapters of my book, I try to convey what I take to be some of the most important work that's been done in the last 50 years. One very important aspect of it has to do with ice drilling and also other kinds of drilling done in the beds of oceans, for example, lake beds. But certainly the most dramatic and most interesting are these very long cores that have been drilled in Greenland and Antarctica to tease out the history of the world's climate over the last, now going back 700,000 years. That work has involved developing very, very ingenious techniques, techniques that many, many scientists have contributed to devising. And, they've been tested many different kinds of ways, so they've come to have a very high degree of reliability. And what people have found doing that work is that if you look at the world's climate history for the last 500,000 to 700,000 years, you find a very exact correspondence between the world's temperature at any given time and the level of greenhouse gases. So I think we can say that we know that for about as sure as we can know anything in science. And we also know that greenhouse gas levels today are much higher than they've been any time in the last 700,000 years because of human activity, and that they're getting higher all the time. Another important aspect of this revolution in climate science is the development of computerized climate modeling, which is an activity that did not exist at all before computers were invented, obviously. This has all happened since World War II. But practically the moment computers were invented, people had the notion that modeling climate and modeling weather would be the most interesting, important, and demanding thing you could possibly do with computers. And so the story of how people have learned to use computers to accurately model climate and convincingly project what will happen as there are changes in greenhouse gas levels is also, I think, a very interesting and important story.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to come, and talk about coal a lot, I think, during this hour and a number of other issues. And I want to sort of, your book deals a lot with coal. We talk and hear a lot about depends on fossil fuels and the oil economy. But in fact, we're dependent on a huge way, not just on oil, but really on coal.
That's right. I think maybe out there in the Middle West, people have more of a sense of this than some Americans do. But in this country, even though you might think of coal as kind of a fuel of the 18th or 19th centuries or something that's now been superseded by all kinds of other ways of turning energy to our uses, coal accounts today for well over half of U.S. electricity generation, and it accounts for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions. Coal is, in fact, the most concentrated single source of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, it's also a very important source of greenhouse gas emissions in some other countries in the world.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that, but sort of tying the two questions that we started with together, I found it interesting, your description in the book, that the presence of coal here in the Midwestern U.S. and the way it's stratified seems itself to be evidence of dramatic changes in the climate, in sea level and catastrophic climate change in Earth's past.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's only peripherally related subject in that that coal was created, long, long, long ago, and it doesn't, the story of how that happened isn't directly related to the kinds of issues we're concerned about now in climate science. But it is interesting that you find these coal appearing in these very regular stratified formations throughout the Northeast and Middle West, and that it turns out the reason why these layers are so regular and why they repeat themselves is because in a geological age several hundred million years ago called the Carboniferous or Pennsylvanian, the world's sea levels rose and fell in a periodic fashion. In connection with enormous ice ages in a supercontinent around the South Pole, where many of today's continents were at that time congregated in one supercontinent, and you had these periodic ice ages, and when water from the world's oceans was sucked up to form ice in the supercontinent, the oceans fell. And when the ice ages ended and all that ice melted, the oceans rose, and for reasons I won't go into now, but as the world's oceans rose and fell and rose and fell, you got conditions that periodically were ideal for creating coal.
So we have in essentially in the geology of coal these things called cyclotherms, which sort of document that.
Yes, the cyclothem is the technical term for these regular periodic coal formations, where you'll find a layer of seam of coal, and then you'll find a seam of, let's say, shale, and then a seam of sandstone, and so on. And then they keep repeating themselves in more or less the same sequence. You may remember there's that old, who was it? Was it Tennessee Williams Ford, the 16 tons? Song. It was a country western song that was very popular around the late 1950s, and I think there's a line in that song which certainly everybody my age remembers, which I think he refers to. I think it's number 9 coal, and that 9 refers to one of these layers. These layers, in the coal mining industry, these seams of coal are numbered.
Very interesting. Just to sort of tease this out further, so these things document, you know, that the Earth has been subject throughout its history to, quote, natural climate changes based on sort of long-term changes, I suppose, in its physical position relative to the sun. And in fact, there are several different cycles of different changes over different timescales.
Yes. The Earth's position relative to the sun changes in complicated and subtle ways that people began to understand early in the last century. A Serbian mathematician and engineer named Milankovic was the person who really figured this out. The physical position of Earth with respect to the sun changes, again, in a complicated periodic pattern, the amount of solar radiation hitting various parts of the Earth changes, increases or decreases, and those changes in turn seem to be associated with the onset and termination of ice ages and with the levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Those specific relationships, however, are still not very well understood, and people are still trying to fathom just exactly what went on.
But now we're talking about a different kind of climate change, that which is created by taking that very same coal and essentially, causing a very rapid chemical reaction that puts a lot of that carbon back in the atmosphere. And I wonder if you could talk about the relationship of the scale of that compared to what we know about climate change in the past.
Well, it's not, of course, not just coal. The coal is not the only source of the greenhouse gas emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere, but it is in the United States the number one source. But in terms of the scale, I don't know how many of your listeners have had a chance yet to go and see Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth film, in which he talks about this in quite a dramatic way. There's a sort of key scene in the movie where he's showing his audience a chart documenting the rise and fall of temperature on the one hand and greenhouse gas emissions on the other hand through the last, I don't know, four or five ice ages. And he shows you how much greenhouse gas levels have gone up and then dropped as ice ages have ended and started and ended and started. And when he gets to sort of the end of this chart, he steps into a cherry picker and then has himself rise in the cherry picker with this greenhouse gas emissions line on the chart to show you that the increase in greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere from the onset of the Industrial Revolution in, you know, the mid-18th century in England to the present day has been about equivalent in magnitude. It's been about the same size of increase in greenhouse gas levels as occurred between the ends and beginnings of ice ages, between the terminations of ice ages and the onset of ice ages. So to repeat that, I know this is a slightly complicated thought, and that's why I think it was a good idea for Al Gore to get in that cherry picker when he was explaining this. The magnitude of change in greenhouse gas levels from the time ice ages started and stopped is about the same as the magnitude of change in greenhouse gas levels that we've seen in the last 250 years. So we're talking about a change in greenhouse gas levels that normally in human history has occurred, in geological history, has occurred over a period of let's say 50 or 100,000 years, occurring in today's world in 250 years. And as Gore is talking about this, he then has himself continue to rise in the cherry picker to show what will happen in the next 50 years if we don't change our way of doing business in the world. And what he shows is that it's going to increase that much again in the next 50 years. So that over a period from, say, 1750 to 2050, greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere will have increased twice as much as they increased between the time an ice age started and the time an ice age stopped. That seems to me, and seems to many people, a very disturbing fact.
Well, we'll get on to other subjects, but I want to just, you know, stay on the coal theme for a minute because it seems that, you know, currently it is such a topic of discussion in terms of the economy and in terms of, you know, the need for more energy. And in our current political climate, support for coal as an energy source seems to be very bipartisan. And even Al Gore, who we were just talking about, didn't talk about it during his 2000 presidential campaign.
That's right. I take the position in my book that the quickest and most efficient way to sharply cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions would be to sharply reduce our reliance on coal. This is a very counterintuitive kind of argument, I will admit. It's counterintuitive because the one fuel we have in enormous abundance in the United States is coal. And so at a time when we're very concerned about energy dependence and rising fuel prices, why in the world would I be proposing that we cut our consumption of the one thing we have? Well, the reason is because coal is the main source and the most concentrated single source of our greenhouse gas emissions. And if one agrees that the most important single issue facing the world right now and our country is to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, then we would do best to focus on doing something about coal first, even though we have it such an abundance. And this doesn't mean, let me hasten to add, that we should never use that coal. You know, scientists and engineers are hard at work on the development of advanced clean coal technologies in which one would be able to, for example, sharply reduce the amount of carbon dioxide emitted in the course of burning coal. People also are hard at work on the development of technologies to capture the carbon dioxide emitted in coal combustion and then essentially store it away in, for example, underground oil and gas beds. That coal, I'm not saying that we will never be able to use that coal we have. Of course, we can go back to using it, but right now, in fact, we don't know how to prevent carbon dioxide from being emitted in enormous quantities when we burn coal. We don't know how to do that economically. And until such time as we do know how to do that economically, I think we should sharply reduce our reliance on coal and replace it by sources of electricity that are either carbon-free or very low carbon.
We'll talk more about that. Let me just reintroduce our guest. During this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with William Sweet, author of the book Kicking the Carbon Habit, Global Warming and the Case for Renewable and Nuclear Energy. We do have a caller waiting to join us and would welcome others around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us in the United States, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener, someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
For years, I've been interested in greenhouse gases, pollution, and all of that. And as a former editor, I've edited some pieces on that, especially here at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. I've been reading in Science, the journal Science, for the last 3 or 4 years at least, maybe longer, that the Germans have perfected, or I don't know if perfected is the proper word, but they were having great difficulty in the Bavarian forest with coal and gas emissions, and they corrected it as far as I know. Hmm. Are we sharing research with them?
That sounds interesting. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, though. You say the Germans had great success with...
I don't know the names of the labs or any of that.
Uh-huh. What is it they had success in doing? In
saving the pine forests in Bavaria. They were becoming denuded. It was on a Nova.
Now, was this as a result of acid rain, perhaps?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yes.
That is coal-related, correct?
Yes. I think there is quite a lot of research cooperation between the United States and Germany, because, you know, partly because of the influence of the Green Party in German politics in the last 10 or 15 years, and partly because Germany is a very sophisticated country technologically.
Right.
Germany has done a lot of very important work in developing innovative and useful technology in this area, and I think it's to be hoped, you know, as you're suggesting, that the United States should
collaborate.
Should look closely at what the Germans are doing.
Right. That's what I'm suggesting.
Yeah.
And also, a few years back, I had the good fortune to go to AAAS when it was in Chicago, and I heard Steven Snyder. He's one of my heroes of the environment. And he won an award for being able to talk to the layperson. And I think if our media had more speakers like Steven Snyder, because there are many others, a lot of people who work at NCAR, for example, the public would learn so much more about this problem instead of having people on who use a lot of jargon and have difficulty explaining and use scientific terms. You understand?
Yeah, I hope Jack Brighton is listening there.
Pardon?
Right. Well, Steven Snyder's been on the show, and Sherwin Newland and a bunch of other. We do our best to cover the science.
I'm sorry, I don't listen all the time.
Yeah, it's okay.
I'm out and about.
Yeah.
And he is very ill right now. I read in the New York Times he has an esoteric kind of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up a good point about this business of acid rain and trees. Coal. Not only is a very important element in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, but it also has a lot of other detrimental effects that I think people tend to lose sight of, partly because people are not aware of just how reliant on coal we are. Coal is estimated by people who have looked into the public health implications of its combustion to be responsible for about 30,000 deaths a year in the United States from air pollution.
Is asthma specifically one of the diseases?
Hundreds of thousands of asthma emissions a year.
Yeah, and more children. I mean, it's a big problem.
When I first saw these numbers, I have to tell you, I didn't really know whether to believe them. I was inclined not to, but I spent quite a lot of time when I was researching this book, looking at the reports and talking to the people about them. Mm-hmm. And at some point recently, somebody pointed out to me that a former senior EPA official pointed out to me that that EPA's estimates of how many lives would be saved and how much sickness would be saved under various future scenarios, in fact, imply that about 30,000 people are dying each year because of U.S. coal combustion. So, there's that, and there's the acid rain effect that you brought up. So there are several compelling reasons, in my opinion, to curtail the use of coal in this country right now until we know how to use it more cleanly.
Someone spoke locally from the EPA, I think the state or regional, and said that Illinois at that time, this was about 5 or 6 years ago, Illinois was amongst the highest incidence of asthma and those types of diseases that are caused directly by pollution.
Uh-huh.
Recent figures I've seen, Illinois had a little bit better record.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I'm especially interested. I have a grandson who's asthmatic.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a child who was very asthmatic who had one of her most serious asthma attacks right there in Champaign. And it turned out to be kind of a blessing in disguise because we went to your local clinic and they put her on a whole new medical regime, which turned out to work.
How about that? Well, I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're at our midpoint here, and I do have another caller to include in our conversation. Let me just mention again our guest during this hour of Focus 580, William Sweet. He is a news editor at the IEEE Spectrum and author of the book we're discussing, Kicking the Carbon Habit, Global Warming and the Case for Renewable and Nuclear Energy. We have a caller waiting on line number 2 in Champaign County. Good morning. Yes.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was I had this unique experience watching NOVA where they were treating global warming and carbon buildup. And I also watched a BBC program on the net about some of the same issues. And the BBC program was very concerned about dissolved carbon dioxide in the oceans. And we think of that as a reservoir, but their implication was that it's affecting the ocean in one of these positive feedback loop sorts of things. It's apparently affecting the coral atolls while we're in this rush of good feeling about the monument north of Hawaii. Global warming and carbon pollution is carbon dioxide dissolved is apparently unbalancing the ecosystem of the ocean in a fairly massive scale. And I was just curious if you found that in your research, and I just couldn't figure out why there was no mention of it in the NOVA program. And is it a contentious issue in some way, or what do you have any basis to comment on that?
Well, I think you're onto something very significant. I don't really go into this in my book, and one reason why I don't is because it seems that this is, as you're suggesting yourself, a bit of a sleeper issue. If I remember right, about half the carbon dioxide that's getting emitted right now, as a result of human activity, is thought to be going into the oceans, and it's, I think, not just thought to be going into the oceans. I think it's now been definitively proved that it's going into the oceans, and so. You might say at first glance, well, that's a relief. It's not showing up in the atmosphere, so we don't have to worry about it changing the climate. But people, yes, are beginning to worry about what the chemical effects on the oceans of all that carbon dioxide are going to be. After all, we know that there are all these, there's all this sea life which use carbon to build shells and various other kinds of structures. You have to wonder if this added carbon dioxide is getting stratified in certain ways in the ocean, whether it's going to start having consequences, even if they're not ultimately climate consequences, consequences that are ecologically so far-reaching that they may also be very disturbing.
Yeah, well, I think one of the speculations was that it would have this what's called a positive feedback, where mm-hmm. it would in some way either slow the absorption of carbon dioxide into the water, or would stop him by stopping impounding it. I guess, and that's the way, by messing with the pot deposition by the coral. I do want to at least make an attempt to take you on head on about nuclear power, because I think that one can make the argument that if one were to take the amount of money that would be envisioned and is envisioned by this administration of subsidizing the nuclear industry and put that into what I regard as decentralized renewable sources of energy, that we would all be much better off. And I think centralized power hopefully will be a thing of the past, and building the huge reactors, I think, is a very wrong-headed way of approaching it. Even if they, no matter what their power source is,
You may be right. I want to maybe clarify what I do favor in my book and what I don't favor. I do not argue in favor of giving the nuclear industry any additional subsidies. In fact, I favor taking away the subsidies they're getting right now. But that's mainly in the form, I believe, of backup insurance coverage.
Not a trivial one.
The whole matter of nuclear subsidies and energy subsidies in general is an incredibly complicated subject and hard to figure out. What I advocate, because I think that we need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions quite sharply immediately to basically get into step with the Kyoto carbon reduction regime, I advocate implementing a rather stiff carbon tax. And the general effects of that tax, a tax on carbon emissions, would be, first of all, to encourage energy conservation throughout the economy, in both the automotive sector and in the industrial sector and in the commercial sector. So that effect would be ubiquitous. But because of the fact that so much more carbon dioxide is emitted per unit energy when you burn coal than when you, say, burn natural gas or even oil, it's to be assumed that a carbon tax is going to have its most sharp and immediate effect on the coal industry. So then the question arises, well, if the carbon tax encourages shutdown of coal-fired electricity generation, what's going to replace it? As I see it, the market would decide. And by market, I mean the market in the broadest sense, not just, strict, sort of demand, supply and demand forces, but the public as part of the political process of deciding what people prefer to see built locally. My opinion is that if you if you were to implement a stiff carbon tax in the United States, the likely effect is that we will see a lot more wind energy used and quite a bit more nuclear energy used. But I may be wrong about that.
Well, the people are, if I might have a moment, the people are going to call that like interfering with the market by adding it. And obviously one knows that the market is sort of a myth. It's constructed by what economic forces there are and what they've lobbied for through the, but the same people that are attacking that are passing bills that in the past here, which is a likely spot for a new nuclear plant. I'm forgetting the name. Exelon got a subsidy from the Department of Energy to the tune of about $23 million to help fill out the paperwork for building the next plant here.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, it's not right. It's the way it was.
No, I mean, it's,
yeah. So, and they had to match it, but I'm fond of pointing out that it was curious that our local representative got $2,000, which is chicken feed, I guess.
Yeah. I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of those kinds of subsidies.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the only thing that you pointed to, the Smith-Anderson Act. Yeah, I guess.
That's
the renewal
insurance
of that.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of underwriting, the U.S. is the reinsurer for the nuclear industry, limiting their liability. And if they can't, if they don't have the faith in building their reactors without that, they shouldn't build them.
That's right. I agree with that.
Well, then they wouldn't, so we have to think of other things.
I'm not sure they wouldn't, actually, but I do agree that they shouldn't need that.
Well, you're pointing to probably to Finland, because that's the only place where it's being built on private money. But I think that as I'm reinstating my opening idea, that if that amount of resources was put into decentralized renewable energy, we would be all living in much better circumstances. Seems to me it would be better for the local economy out here in the rather economically depressed farmland of East Central Illinois.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay,
sure.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple of calls. I promise I'll get right to them. But there's a concept that I think is an important one for us to cover before we run out of time, which happens too quickly, and that is, the scale of what we need to do to address reductions in carbon emissions into the atmosphere. There's no silver bullet. There's no one thing that's going to do it. And there's this concept called stabilization wedges, which, some people are talking about. There has to be, there's a big wedge that is the wind generation of electricity. And there's other wedges. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, it is difficult to talk about these scale issues. I agree, you're bringing up a very important subject. There are a couple of professors at Princeton who have developed this model where they identify 14 ways in which we could stabilize greenhouse gas emissions worldwide over the next 50 years, and sort of quantified what it would take in each of those wedges to get the job done. And it's a very useful. The names of the, well, one of the names of the professors is Sokolow. So if you do a Google on Sokolow, S-O-C-O-L-O-W, you'll easily find him and his carbon wedge model. It's being very widely discussed. One of the things that's helpful about that model is that it shows you what sort of scale of effort is required in different areas to get the job done, solar versus wind versus clean coal, and so on. Let me just refer your audience to that work directly, because I think it's easier to look at it than for me to try to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of looking at the matter of scale is just to go back to coal, for example, is to bear in mind that we're generating about 55% of our electricity from coal and about 20% of our electricity from nuclear energy right now. And that's a huge amount of electricity. So if one were to cut, let's say, our electricity. If we wanted to cut our emissions from the electricity sector by, say, 20%, that would be tantamount to shutting down about half the coal-fired plants in the United States. And so I hope this begins to convey something of the scale at which things have to happen to make really serious difference. a really serious difference in the amount of greenhouse gas that we're emitting right now in our economy.
And we talk about stabilization. That means keeping the carbon emissions where they are now.
That's right.
You know, and that's, you know, the big problem is economies are growing, and especially, I mean, the U.S. economies are growing. So our emissions are increasing every year, but that's nothing compared to the rate of increase in the developing world, especially China and India. And that's, that again, that relates to the scale of the challenge.
That's right.
Okay. Well, with that, let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Someone in Champaign, next, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really believe that the real hurdle that we face in terms of overcoming this problem is not so much technological, but more really political, and to maybe a lesser extent psychological, and a matter of vision. But there are lots and lots of people, and I'm sure you know this, who all over the world who have come up with lots of viable ways to get at, you know, and there's no one solution, as you said, but, you know, I mean, I would just cite, for instance, what was laid out in Natural Capitalism by Paul Hawkins and Avery and Hunter Lovins in terms of how you could transform the economy while, you know, creating a system of, well, lots of different ways of doing things, just that we're, you know, living lighter on the earth. But the real problem we face is that, you know, there are politics that are, you know, backed up by entrenched economic interests that, you know, are really fighting against allowing this sort of thing to happen. I mean, it's happening to some extent, but it could go ahead so much more quickly and efficiently if it weren't for the fact that, I mean, just use the example of this country, and hopefully, you know, some other countries are going to have less of a problem with this. But, you know, we've got a Congress and especially an executive branch that are so in bed with the fossil fuel industry that, you know, it's like they're fighting against it tooth and nail, and there are all these AstroTurf organizations that are funded by ExxonMobil and other places like that, you know, trying to say the science is, you know, not there and all that. And I mean, it seems to me that that's the real problem, not that we can't figure out a way to turn things around.
I agree with that, and I would add that I think there's a very, you know, closely related problem in the politics of this in the United States. If you compare this country with what's going on in countries that have agreed to the Kyoto Plan for reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, the countries that have not just signed the Kyoto Protocol but ratified it and are now trying to implement it. You know, if you look at the discussions going on about energy policy in countries like Germany and England and the Scandinavian countries, discussions of energy policy in those countries is dominated by the question of how are we going to get enough energy in the next 10, 20, 30 years while at the same time reducing our greenhouse gas emissions as we have agreed to do in the Kyoto regime. In the United States, there is nothing like this discussion going on. And I agree with you that the influence of the fossil fuel industries in the United States is a very important reason behind this. Another very important reason, I think, is the fact that politicians have not had the guts to get up there and put it to the American public squarely. People have not been willing to say that this is what we need to do and this is why we need to do it, and it's not going to be cost-free. We need to decide how we want to go about doing this, the same way that publics in countries like Germany, England, and Denmark have been deciding how are we going to go about doing this. This discussion needs to start right now in the United States, and my hope is, I mean, my modest hope with my book is that I want to try to do something to get that debate going.
Hope the caller will forgive me. We have a couple other people waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number three. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Mrs. Ross Martin, and my husband was dean of engineering research and development, and he was so pleased when the university went to, out beyond my depths when I say what I'm talking about, but for heating the university And I don't know what they use, nuclear oil, I guess, yeah. And but when he came home and said, well, the university is going to change back to coal, and I said, oh, you're kidding me, because I'm such an environmentalist. And I said, I don't believe it. He said, yes, they're going back to coal. And as I said, he's been gone 20 years, so this has got to be 30 years ago. And then I start. He said, but they're going to wash the emission from coal, the coal smoke. And I said, oh, well, but every time I go by those great big smokestacks just off of Neal Street from the University of Illinois power plant, and he had a lot to do with that power plant, and I see that smoke coming out, I almost drive up over the curb or hit a tree or something. I wouldn't hit a tree. But anyway, I can't believe that the university, and then I see these trains coming along that I see loaded with coal, and I think, why doesn't somebody do something? I know that President of the White House wouldn't know coal from marble. But anyway, aside from politics, I just can't understand why the university is still burning Illinois coal. I suppose, well, somebody said, well, it comes from Wyoming.
Well, reliance on coal has been increasing, not decreasing. The situation you're describing is completely typical of what's been going on nationwide in the last decades. We've gone back to coal, and we're relying on it more and more. And this was a very important factor in the 2000 and 2004 national elections. The elections were decided in key coal states like Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and the Bush administration has been giving the coal industry pretty much everything it wants, and whenever the subject of climate change came up, President Bush made it pretty clear that he was not intending to do anything that would be costly. So there you have it.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple of callers waiting and only about maybe 7 minutes left, so I'm going to try to squeeze them both in. We'll go next to someone in Champaign, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. The last caller's call was interesting. I lived here when I was a kid. The power plant was coal-fired, and the town was very dirty. Of course, a lot of homes were still being heated with coal at that time. When they switched back to coal, I thought, oh, no, the town is going to be very dirty again, but I couldn't hardly see the difference, so I think they are doing a good job of scrubbing it, probably as good as anybody can do with current technology. But the reason I called is my big concern is I don't think anybody is looking at least I never hear it talked about, the amount of conventional energy that goes into any alternative energy source. For example, building a power plant takes a ton of steel and concrete. Well, concrete is, you know, sand, gravel, and limestone that has to be quarried or mined using a ton of conventional energy. And then the cement, to make the cement, you have to burn the lime, which takes a ton of energy. They use coal, coke, natural gas, and sometimes even used tires. And does anybody look at, like, how much? And then, of course, the steel, same thing, ton of conventional energy to mine the ore, make the steel, make it into the whatever, I-beams or whatever, you know, form they use it. Same with ethanol. It's just a way of, I mean, it takes a ton of diesel, other petroleum products and natural gas to grow the corn and to truck it to the place. And then you use a bunch of coal to distill it. So it's basically using petroleum products to be able to put coal in your gas tank. And solar panels take a lot of energy to produce. Windmills, think of all the steel, and then trucking this heavy thing.
Yeah, I think we take your point.
Site.
Yeah.
Does anybody? Everybody looks at it just from the money. How do you
people?
Make it
people. There are people who look at these considerations and try to do calculations that take all that into account. It's of course.
Well, where do you
it's of course incredibly complicated to do. But people do make a serious effort to do that. I guess my short comment on your interesting comment is just that These calculations are so complicated, and so you know you're talking about so many different things that I think it's probably, as a general rule, a mistake to base specific policies on them. You know, specific, let's say, subsidy policies or policies to encourage this kind of technology or discourage that kind of technology. It seems to me to be more sensible to just change the ground rules, for example, by enacting a carbon tax or an energy tax on the one hand, or something that countries like Germany and Denmark have done that's also very effective, is to simply give production subsidies for certain kinds of energy, such as wind, solar, whatever. You simply say that, okay, if you can produce wind electricity at this price, we'll give you so-and-so much extra to make it worth your while. This has a very powerful incentive effect. But I think if you try to, you know, if you try to base policy on these very, very complicated calculations about how much energy goes into doing this or how much energy goes into doing that, you get kind of tangled in knots. And it's probably better just to let – that's something I think it's probably better to let market forces determine on their own.
Okay. I want to ask a quick follow-up question, and actually this is a subject that someone mentioned to me before the show, and that's, you know, the role, possible role of biomass, not just, you know, corn ethanol and sugarcane ethanol and so forth, but, for example, miscanthus. Have you looked at that in particular?
I've not looked at it as much as I should have, but it is an important issue. I was thinking of it during the preceding call because there's debate going on now out in your part of the country about how much energy you need, how much energy you use in the process of making ethanol from corn. And something we're starting to see is people using coal to in some plants, in some ethanol production plants. And if, when you do that, the greenhouse gas effect is not merely not positive. It's actually negative. You actually end up creating more greenhouse gas emissions than you save. By replacing gasoline with ethanol. So it just so happens, Jack, that a quite important report came out this week on biofuels done by the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. in collaboration with a couple of German governmental organizations, drawing quite considerably on Germany's experience with this and Germany's studies of the subject. And this report says flatly that current ethanol production techniques are not a cost-effective way of bringing down greenhouse gas emissions. More futuristic biofuels, using the kinds of relying on the kinds of you know inputs that you were describing, I think, like cellulosic ethanol and ethanol from municipal wastes. There are a variety of ideas of this kind that are very promising. Those approaches eventually will be a very effective way of bringing down greenhouse gas emissions, but they will not help us with the problem of how to start bringing down greenhouse gas emissions right now.
Okay. We have just about 3 minutes left, and a couple callers will squeeze in at least one more. Line number 4 in Mattoon. Good morning.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I heard that most all of our nuclear plants were not by one basic plan. Our construction was different, and all the plans were different. There was no standard, and that in Europe there was about one standard for construction of nuclear plants, and they were safer and more efficient. This was several years ago, and I was just wondering, we might be better off if we did have a good standard, and maybe they would be safer and more efficient.
Well, you know, the U.S. government has, you know, going back to the Clinton years, has been trying to encourage the industry to develop essentially two standard plans for construction of new nuclear power plants to make the situation a little bit more like what we find in France, for example, where every single plant is essentially the same as every other one, and they have a very good safety record and a very good record of producing electricity efficiently with those plants. So I think we're moving in the direction you're suggesting. How successful there being, I don't know. Time will tell.
Okay. Well, we're really at the point we're going to have to stop, and I have to apologize to one more caller that unfortunately we just don't have the time to take. I guess, you know, as a way of summing up, your recommendation is that, you know, we look carefully at the technologies that would you know, essentially reduce carbon emissions while also meeting our energy needs with the idea that we do have those energy needs.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, okay, I guess we'll leave it there. I will suggest, though, for folks, if you'd like to read more on the subject, the book is Kicking the Carbon Habit, Global Warming and the Case for Renewable and Nuclear Energy. The author, our guest, William Sweet, S-W-E-E-T, and the publisher is Columbia University Press. And Bill Sweet, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.